Alan, Kenji made me reorganize my kitchen.
That sounds annoying. It sounds like something he would do. Just kidding. I don't know. Your home kitchen.
Yeah. My home kitchen.
Okay.
Reorganizing the work kitchen is like a somewhat, it's like a baby step constant kind of ongoing process of trying to re-recognize our needs and meet them, you know, like it's a nonstop, like it's always happening a little bit. And then there are times when it doesn't happen for too long. And then we really need to like dig in and figure out a way to make some changes. Like before we entered this summer, we made some, some reasonably big changes that now in retrospect just don't seem like anything changed at all. It's so crazy actually. Yeah. But yeah, that's not what I'm talking about. When's the last time you like looked at your, like, I don't know, there's like a moment where like you just like every day you like walk into your kitchen, you know where things are, you know things are arranged in a way that you understand. Maybe it's a little bit of organized chaos, maybe it's like 100% fully like clean, organized, and everything makes sense. I haven't spent a lot of time in your home kitchen, so I don't really know what that's like for you, but you know, varying times. My home kitchen like ranges from like being, you know, quite well organized and, you know, like quite well streamlined in terms of the things that I have on hand. And, you know, like every once in a while I'll do a bit of a purge for food that we haven't really gone through and stuff like that. And but like everything's generally in the same spot. The equipment's generally in the same spot, and you know where everything is, and it all kind of makes sense. And then one day you walk into your kitchen and you're like, why did I do this like this? This makes absolutely no sense. Like it's chaos and it's nonsensical. And I have no idea how I wound up here.
And do you mean primarily like equipment and appliances, or do you mean like the actual food?
Mostly equipment, appliances, you know, and smallwares and things like that, but also food. Like basically my home kitchen, we moved into this house in the fall of 20. I can never remember this. I'm really bad at year dates. It's either 2018 or 2019. And since then, and when we moved in, I made a really good effort to, you know, sort of set up the kitchen in a way that was going to feel usable to me and to my sister, who you know, I share a kitchen with. So we made some decisions together. I made some unilateral decisions and explained to her why I thought they they were good. And, you know, I just sort of like operated under the assumption that when I made those decisions, those were the correct decisions. And I like to reserve my, I don't know, like mental attention for things that I think are actually important or matter. And so once I've kind of decided like, okay, this is how I'm going to set this up, then I try not to think too much about that anymore and just make little tweaks here and there if I find that things are inconvenient. I'm not really big on huge rethinks. I think that's like a, I think that's a really strong secret underlying like component of my personality.
Okay.
But then like it always happens like at some point, and I'll be shocked if this doesn't also happen to you. I don't know, maybe it's totally different for you, but at some point I'll just like walk into my kitchen, or whether it's my kitchen or like my studio that I'm sitting in right now or my bedroom, just like one day I walk in and I'm like, none of this makes sense. Like this is just an archaic thought process at work, and it needs to be completely reassessed. And two things happened last week that like just like were the instigating incidents for this, you know, complete like rejection of my previous organizational structure in my home kitchen. And thing one was I decided that I wanted to have a rice maker.
You didn't have a rice maker until now?
No. Which I know seems a little weird because I'm a big proponent of them. But I guess like the thing is that I generally don't cook a ton of rice, right. Or I hadn't until the last couple of years, mm-hmm. wherein I have been cooking a lot more, because I've been doing a lot more learning and experimentation about Asian food, mm-hmm. and trying to incorporate more Asian food into my repertoire and my consciousness. So yeah, I wanted to get a rice cooker, which, yeah, I didn't have one of. And then I was also, and so I was like, kind of, I don't like to really keep like small appliances on the counter. They take up a lot of space. You need that counter space for things. If you have to start moving small appliances around, it's just like really annoying. So I like to have them all like away, mm-hmm. like for them to all have a spot, and they live in their spot until you need them. And then you pull them up on the counter and use them, and then you put them away. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really have a spot for my rice cooker. So I was like, okay, where am I going to put a rice cooker? To be fair, I have, like most of the time when I have been cooking rice, certain varieties, I've been cooking them in, my Instant Pot. So that's sort of like my pressure cooker's been my rice cooker.
Right.
Anyway, so wanted to get a rice cooker, and then I was watching some older Kenji videos that are Japanese food related, because I've been trying to cook lots of Japanese food, and mm-hmm. there's a few things that I know that are like, you know, childhood dishes for him, and I was like really curious to get his take. So I was watching these Kenji videos, mm-hmm. I'd seen them before, in some cases like several times, and so while I was watching them, there were certain things that I, you know, like little bits of things that I didn't remember about how he did the technique or whatever that I was trying to sort of refresh my memory on. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, because I'd seen them before, my attention was like available to wander to things, other things in the video that I don't necessarily usually notice, because I'm watching more about like what he's cooking and listening to what he's saying about the food mm-hmm. that he's preparing. Mm-hmm. And while my attention was wandering, you know, I was picking up on these little bits and pieces about how Kenji has his kitchen organized. And I was like, oh, that's smarter than how I have my kitchen organized.
So what's an example?
For one thing, you know, like he has a vast pantry, mm-hmm. and I've always sort of like been, you know, really impressed by the amount of the number of different ingredients that he has in his pantry. And, you know, for myself, unless I'm like actively involved in like trying to cook certain things, I'm a little bit resistant to having too many things in my home pantry, mm-hmm. because I'm worried that, you know, like I'll bring them in and then I won't use them and then they'll be worthless. You know, like mm-hmm. if it's like spices and things like that, they don't hold their, you know, their pungency for super long unless you really have a good way of storing them. And so I'm always a little bit resistant to like, you know, completely stock out my pantry, you know, for all different types of purposes, because I'm afraid that, you know, I'll lose a lot of food if I do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, clearly Kenji does a lot of cooking, you know, both for his YouTube channel and also just, you know, like he cooks, I think probably three or more meals a day, pretty much for his family. Mm-hmm. Or at least, you know, while they were mostly at home during COVID and while his restaurant was closed, he was doing all the cooking at home, I think, or most of it. And
he has
a lot of meals. What's that?
He has a restaurant?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, it's called Wurst Hall, I think.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's like a sausage beer hall, something, something. I don't know the full extent of like his ownership, but I'm pretty sure, yeah, it's like his place. Yeah.
Okay.
So anyways, my mind was wandering. I was seeing Kenji pull he has a spice drawer in his pantry. That's just like, you know, all arranged in little IKEA jars. And he just has like, I don't know, 50 maybe little IKEA jars, and they're all labeled and, mm-hmm. and clearly like then your mind starts to like go in this direction. Like, okay, so, you know, obviously you don't buy spices in IKEA jars. So that means that every time Kenji buys spices, he has to transfer some of them into this IKEA jar and then keep the bulk bag or whatever stored somewhere else if the whole thing won't fit in the IKEA jar, which often mm-hmm. it won't. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of like going through all these things in my head and I was like, does it, you know, like, is the trade-off worth it or something? Because like my spices, for the most part, were just in a bin in their original containers, be that jar, bag, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
But it was always frustrating because I was like pulling this bin out of a cupboard and it's full of all kinds of things that I don't need access to. And I have to unpack a bunch of them to find the things that I do need access to. It's just not, I don't know. It's not ergonomic. It's not efficient. It's not convenient. And so I started to get a little bit jealous. And then he also like, he keeps all his like storage containers for food and stuff in a drawer that's like right below his workstation. So if he's like, and then also in that same drawer are like bowls for mise en place and things like that. And then all his knives and kitchen tools are like in a drawer on that same kind of little island. I don't think it's actually an island. It's just like a piece of countertop, but that's where he does most of his prep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just like started to watch how he was working and where he was pulling his tools from and where he was pulling his equipment from. And I was like, man, that seems better than what I'm doing. And then like, yeah, the day after that, I got my rice maker and then I put it away in the drawer where I had sort of figured out where I could put it. But then there was a whole bunch of stuff that I had to relocate. And then I was just like, oh man, this whole thing is a disaster. This whole thing needs to go.
And so you spent the next 12 hours, you're like, we're going to start from the beginning. Everything's coming out onto the counter and we're just starting from square one kind of thing.
Piece by piece. So far, my sister and I went through the pantry, got rid of a bunch of things, equipment and food that we knew that we were probably never going to use or that was expired. I went to IKEA and bought a bunch of little spice jars. So far, it's step by step. It's not all going to happen in one day. I have other priorities, but I have a pretty good mental map for what I'm going to do. It's probably going to take me a couple of weeks to get there, but I'm tearing it all down. I'm burning it all down to the ground now.
And is this going to be an episode? We're going to do a tour.
That's not a bad idea.
This old house style tour of your kitchen.
It would be great for a video episode if we ever did those. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my pal, Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Great.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
I'm pretty happy with my kitchen organization. For me, the big tenants
are... I expect that yours is probably much closer to Kenji's than mine was originally. Some of the decisions that I originally made, I'm just like, why did I decide that that was a good idea? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can kind of see it, but in retrospect, I'm like, man, I sure keep a lot of things that I use often, like far from where I'm working. And that just seems something that I wouldn't do, you know? Like,
we did a pretty massive... And by we, I mean my father-in-law and Lisa did a really massive kitchen renovation 8 or 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was able to spend a lot of time thinking about how everything would be laid out. I think one of the most important like high level tenets you mentioned is like, don't plan to store things on the counter. The only, for me, the rule was if you use it every day, it can be on the counter. So the coffee maker we use every day, it's on the counter. The knife block we use every day, it's on the counter. Oil, salt, that's about it, actually. The coffee grinder. Everything else needs a home, not on the counter, because counter space is gold. And then the two factors and the two main factors in determining where to store something are where do you use it? Like if it's a tool, where do you use it in the kitchen and how often do you use it in the kitchen?
Yeah.
So things that you use daily or almost daily need to be stored where you use them or nearby where you use them. Mm-hmm. things that you only use once a week or more rarely need to be in not prime real estate, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Where they're not taking up as much usable space or whatever.
Yeah. I think so in terms of tools and appliances, I'm quite happy with our organization. I will admit that although I do buy a lot of things in bulk and I have like a large format pantry in our basement that I use to stock the somewhat organized areas in our kitchen. That's a good system. But like we've got, you know, a corner cupboard that has a Lazy Susan in it. That's just a disaster. It's just like any dry good we've ever purchased over the last 5 years is just like shoved in there.
Yeah. There's probably stuff that's like fallen over the back of the Lazy Susan. Yeah, exactly. It's just in the back underneath. Corner of that cupboard. And you're like, oh, I'll get it when I need it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And our fridge, likewise. I mean, besides, you know, raw meat on the bottom and stuff, it's you don't know if the ketchup's going to be in the door or in the top shelf or what. But yeah, we do have one good dry goods cupboard where it's like we buy in bulk things like baking powder, baking soda, whatever, flour, all that. We'll have bulk containers of it in the basement and we'll stock clear glass labeled jars.
That's cool. Like my kind of the problem that I'm having now is I don't really have a place for bulk storage. I have my pantry that's in my kitchen. That's pretty much the home for anything that I have to store in bulk.
Yes.
Because there's not really any other spot in the house to just, we don't have a ton of storage space, I guess, is the problem.
Yeah.
In this house, it's like, it's a lot of livable space. It feels like feels a little too big sometimes, honestly. But yeah, in terms of like storage space, it's pretty limited. We can't use our basement for anything like that because we're turning it into a basement suite. So I suppose like maybe after all of our like renovations are done or something, I could put a shelf in our mechanical room downstairs and put a couple things in there if I needed to or something. But yeah, that's kind of the problem I'm having, is that like I want to have easily accessible amounts of things that I use all the time. But I also don't want to buy like a 2 kilo bag of sugar if I need it. You know, like I need to buy like a 10 kilo bag of sugar.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I feel like an idiot.
Right.
And
yeah,
so,
of course.
You know, and then like 10 kilo bag of sugar is like the smallest possible amount of sugar that I could buy and feel like I wasn't being robbed or something like that. But then, yeah, I have to find a spot to store that bag. And then, you know, as that bag depletes, it's taking up less room, and that room that it's taking up less of gets taken up by other things. And so it's just this sort of like constant kind of everything is moving around all over the place. And I want to kind of try and get away from that a little bit. So the problem that I'm trying to solve right now is like, you know, what are things that really just aren't necessary in the kitchen at all that I can just like get rid of and then reclaim some of that space? And there are a few things like that. I feel bad for throwing away to-go containers and things like that, especially when they can be reused for like storage or for heating things up in and stuff like that. But they just like pile up over time and then they take up usable space and stuff like that. Also, when like, I thought it would be a good idea to have all my pots and pans in a drawer that's like right across from the stove. And that has been very convenient. But that drawer is like right beneath where I do most of my prep work. And it would just be, when I was watching Kenji's setup, I was like, it would be so much better if I had like containers for like mise en place and like, you know, containers for storing food in this place and tools and things rather than my pots and pans. Because when I'm prepping, I'm not actually usually accessing my pots and pans. It's like when I'm standing over by the stove. And so really they should be in a cupboard that's close to the stove, which, you know, the drawer is across from it, but the drawer could be much better used. And so I don't want to move my pots and pans out of the drawer because they're so easily accessible. Like I just open the drawer and I can lift them straight out rather than having to dig for something that's behind something else in a cupboard.
Right.
But I feel like, yeah, I feel now like, if I open that drawer and there were little bowls for mise en place and maybe like my extra cutting boards and, you know, the few things that I use for prep, and they're right in front of the prep station, that would just be much better. So
is it your experience? Sorry. Is your experience like mine in that the drawer that is built into the bottom of your oven is just the most useless and difficult to use thing ever.
Yeah, it's awful. Every drawer that's in the bottom of a range is just like a useless piece of junk.
It like never slides well, and it's impossible to like, you have to stack things obviously in it, and so it's hard to get things out. Yeah,
I'm gonna use it though. I just decided, like, while I was doing this, I was like, there's a couple pots that I don't use tons, mm-hmm. but that, you know, I like to have by the stove. And actually, the drawer on my current stove, I think it has, I'm not sure, I think it might have wheels on the bottom of it or something, but it seems like it opens better than most of the ones that I've had before. I think I'm going to put like some drawer liner in it and just put, you know, like a few things where I don't have to stack anything, just mm-hmm. like maybe two pots, maybe three, where I can open the drawer and just easily just pull them out. Mm-hmm. Even though it's kind of, you have to bend down to get them. Like I need spots for a couple of things that I don't really have a spot for right now. And what we store in there is like sheet pans for baking and stuff like that, which, you know, that's a fine place for them. And we don't use them very often. And so I don't have to use that drawer very often, which is usually a benefit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like most of those pans, aside from like one sheet pan that we use basically for baking, you know, anything that we're going to just reheat in the oven on or whatever, mm-hmm. most of those pans don't get touched except for like maybe twice or three times a year. And so, and I do have a big corner cabinet that doesn't actually have a Lazy Susan in it, and you know, that's the prime spot for things that I'm only going to use like twice a year. Like I don't mind digging for something like that. Like that's the consequence of having everything else be in an accessible spot. And so, you know, if once a year when I'm gonna like roast a turkey, I have to like dig to the back of my corner cupboard to pull out the turkey roasting pan, you know, mm-hmm. it's not the end of the world.
I have to correct something I said in the last episode.
Oh, follow up.
It's one of those things that I correct, and it's only important to me to correct it. Like, it's not like anyone's going to call in and be upset about it. But I said that Mario Batali's father, Armandino Batali, was an executive for Bombardier, but he was an executive for Boeing. I just had my Canadian glasses on.
I was kind of wondering when you said that, because Bombardier is a Canadian company, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was actually, like, oh, that's interesting.
It's not far-fetched, because I don't know why this would be, how these would be related. But Mario Batali's mother is of French-Canadian ancestry. But anyways, I don't know why I had Bombardier.
So then she got drummed out of her town when she married a Boeing exec?
I guess so, yeah. I don't know if she was actually born in Quebec or what, but anyways. Boeing, not Bombardier. And then one other random open-ended piece of follow-up. Have you started watching the new season of The Bear? It just came out.
I have, Alan.
Oh, yeah? Okay, cool.
Yes.
I just watched the first episode last night.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's been great so far.
Okay.
But I haven't been just like binging it, which I think is good.
Yeah. Really savoring it.
Well, kind of not on purpose. It's sort of like, with the first season, I kind of couldn't help but watch the next episode. The second mm-hmm. season, I feel a little bit less compelled to just like jump into the next episode as soon as the first one ends. Yeah. I have them all, so I could do that, but I just haven't really, whether it's I don't have enough time or that it's just not as like cliffhangery or something. I'm not quite sure, but
having only watched the first episode of the second season, my feeling is that it's nowhere near as cliffhangerly. Yeah, it doesn't propel you into, like, in a way. We never even really finished. I think we only talked about the first half of the first season, right? In our conversation.
I know, which is annoying to me. Honestly, it's like a little bug in my. It's like a little. What do you call that? Be in my bonnet every time we get on a call. I'm like,
every time
I finish talking about the bear.
I don't know how we feel about spoilers, but I feel like a lot of the big surprise at the end of the first season has kind of been completely undermined or undercut by how it's played out now. I don't know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Like they,
I mean, for me,
can we just talk about it or no?
Well, actually, we shouldn't really talk about it. In fact, what we should do is talk about the end of season one when we go to make an episode about season two, which we should do after you've watched the rest of season two.
Okay.
So, yeah, we should probably just drop it for now because I have a lot of things that I could say about it. But I do, I was actually happier about the ending of season one after I watched the first episode of season two.
That's weird. Okay, we'll talk about it later. What do you want to talk about instead then, Shale? If we can't talk about...
We actually do have a topic. And I don't know if we teased this. I think maybe we teased this topic in our last episode.
Sort of, yeah.
Or I guess maybe we teased it, but we weren't sure when we were actually going to do this episode. Mm-hmm. Because last episode was book reports, and you had said that you were in the middle of reading Counterintelligence by Jonathan Gold. Mm-hmm. And that eventually we were going to definitely have a conversation about Jonathan Gold and that book. But you finished it. So I guess you didn't take my advice to like take it slow and do it over the course of the entire summer.
No. And it was just,
which
it was,
I can
kind of
see
like
why that would be impossible after reading a few more pages of it.
Yeah. Since then. I was a little bit OCD. Like I just said that I was going to read it and I needed to read it and get through it. It's a little bit of a difficult, I don't know. Sorry, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves as we are wont to do, but it's a little bit of a difficult book to read beginning to end because it's structured as an encyclopedia, basically. It's all right. it's a series of 200 or more entries that are listed alphabetically and sectioned by letter. So it doesn't really propel you the same way as something that's structured like Heat, where it's like you're trying to, you want to find out, you know, what's going to happen next or what you're going to learn next. It's more,
yeah, it's not really a narrative.
Yeah, exactly. But anyways, I know we've mentioned him a dozen times or more on the show, but we should just take a step back and say, tell everyone who Jonathan Gold, was a food and music critic, a writer born in 1960 in Los Angeles, spent most of his life living in and writing about Los Angeles for publications like LA Weekly and the Los Angeles Times, and other national publications like Rolling Stone. He was also based briefly out of New York sometime around the year 2000, where he wrote for Gourmet magazine.
I did not know that.
It's true. Yeah. He moved to New York, I think in 1999 or 2000, and then went back to LA a couple years later when his wife, became chief editor of LA Weekly or something like that.
Right.
And, a fantastic writer. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his food criticism. He had a column.
He was the first food writer to win a Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. He had a food column called Counterintelligence, started in 1986, in LA Weekly. It was later published also in the LA Times. But what was really unique about it, and I think probably what a lot of our conversation today is going to be about, is that it was kind of unique. And his wife even described it as disruptive, that he would often write about places that did not get very much ink, very, very much press, things like hot dog stands or, you know, burrito joints, yeah, tamale joints, that kind of thing, things that weren't, for a number of reasons, and a lot of it has to do with race and immigration issues, like things that weren't really considered serious food and so wouldn't get very much written about them. But he not only wrote about them, he did it at a very high level. And yeah, so he was very influential in Southern California and Los Angeles in particular. And yeah, he died in 2018 quite suddenly of pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's actually not a full collection, but a lot of his counterintelligence column pieces are collected in a book called Counterintelligence. And there's also a documentary about him called City of Gold. I can't remember what year it came out, but a really great movie about his work.
Yeah. I can't exactly remember when it came out either. I think somewhere around like 2014. Or
I was going to say 2012, but yeah, I think maybe. Something like that. So where to begin, Shale?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Good question. I think, like, since, well, we should begin with with a confession, I think, and that's that I haven't actually read much of the book yet, like probably less than a quarter of Counterintelligence. My intention was to have read most of it by the time we wanted to have this conversation. But yeah, I guess in the summer I have less free time than you do or something.
Oh, absolutely. Our lives are almost opposite that way.
Yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I haven't really been able to dig into it too hard, but I am like relatively familiar with Jonathan Gold's writing and his writing style. And I have seen City of Gold. In fact, I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure, but I think I saw it in the theater.
Oh, really?
Like, I think it played at either the Metro. I think it played at the Metro Theater, like, when it came out. And that was the only way that I thought I was ever going to be able to see it. Totally, or, like, maybe not when it came out, exactly when it came out, but, like, a little bit after it had done some festivals and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think it had, like, a 1 or 2 night engagement at the Metro Theater. And I went and saw it because I thought it might be my only opportunity to see it.
That sounds exactly then, like something they would play there. Cause I've seen like, you know, El Bulli documentaries there and stuff like that. So yeah, they would definitely screen that.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure. And then later on I was able to acquire a copy of it from the internet, being unable to purchase it anywhere. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, now I'm realizing that I probably should have checked the library.
Right. For those of you listening in Edmonton, if you have a Edmonton Public Library card, once I return my DVD copy of City of Gold, it will be available for you.
To rent, provided that you have a way to play a DVD.
At the Strathcona. Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, it's funny. I just watched it last night, actually. And I went to put it into my 25-year-old DVD player, and the tray won't open. Like, it's broken. It won't open. So I had to watch it on my 21-year-old desktop. I don't know if it's that old, but my Dell that has a DVD tray still. But
I mean, it could be that old.
Yeah. Who even knows? To me, there's probably kind of two levels to talk about in terms of his food writing, neither of which we are very well equipped to discuss, but the two levels being like the actual writing and why it's so great and compelling, why it's great writing and how it's unique from most of the food writing that we're used to.
Right.
But then also the higher level, like the idea of visiting. It's quite a diverse, he goes to all kinds of restaurants, but it really is not the kinds of restaurants that usually get reviewed by places like by, you know, the New York Times or by the LA Times. It really is.
Or he does review those restaurants.
Yes.
But they're just on completely equal footing with every other restaurant, be it. Like you said, a hot dog stand or like a taco joint that's in a strip mall that, you know, like probably a million commuters drive by every day in LA and never bother to stop and go to, but that like are a center for something specific in a very specific community to get like a certain cultural need met that they can't have met anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he does this like amazing job of like figuring out what that need is or what that little bit of culture is that this restaurant that might otherwise be overlooked, like he really, I don't know, just has this need to, or this curiosity that like makes him want to like dig in and find out what this restaurant or establishment or whatever is providing.
Mm-hmm.
That's like unique or something.
It might sound obvious, like to people who don't follow, say, like a local food scene, it seems obvious that like, well, like any restaurant is up for review and why wouldn't you go to this diverse, you know, selection of restaurants. But if you are following the like quote unquote scene in a, even in a place like Edmonton, there's this kind of schedule or routine to food writing where most of what's written is a hot new restaurant opens up. And then yeah. if they're a good food writer, they'll give it a few months to get its act worked out and then they'll visit it and then they'll write mm-hmm. about it. And within a few months, all of the major publications, so in Edmonton, it's like the CBC, the Journal, the Sun, they all do their review of that restaurant. And then that's kind of it. And they wait for the next hot restaurant to open up.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's not usually like that restaurant is not usually written about again, unless there's some compelling reason, like there's some change there, a change of ownership, a change of chef or concept or whatever. And then perhaps mm-hmm. it's revisited. But it, like even you think back to the places we worked, that was, there was a expected rhythm to that where it's like, okay, Zalt's opened in November. And then in January, the CBC wrote about it. And then in April, the Sun wrote about it. And then June's Deli opened in September. And in January, CBC wrote about it. In April, the Journal wrote about it. And then it was never yeah. discussed again. And a lot of these, not all of them, but the majority, I would say, of the restaurants in that are the reviews that are collected in Counterintelligence, they are there to serve, like you said, to serve a specific need of usually of a, of an immigrant community. And they're serving traditional cuisine. And yeah, it's actually shocking how rarely that is written about in Edmonton. And I think we're not, yeah. it's interesting to me, sorry, a little sidebar there. There's a couple subtitles to the Counterintelligence collection. It says Counterintelligence, Where to Eat in the Real Los Angeles, The Indispensable Eats Guide to America's Most Diverse Food City. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me, like, what is, I don't think that Gold wrote those subtitles, but
taglines,
it'd be interesting to know what is meant by the real Los Angeles. I also, when I first found the collection, I thought that someone, say, from New York might take exception to Los Angeles being called America's most diverse food city. But, mm-hmm. you know, having read the book and watched the documentary now, and actually having had some time to think about the history of immigration and race relations in Los Angeles, I'm convinced now that it is.
That's a true, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, there's so much to unpack in just that, like in that like last 3 minutes of things that you were saying about food criticism. I had about 8 things that I wanted to jump in and say.
Okay, what's number one?
Man,
I'll start a list.
Okay, so yeah, the cycle of food criticism. That's the thing for me that's like, so I don't know, just like for me. Reading Jonathan Gold's writing has always been like really refreshing. And when I first started reading it, I didn't really understand why. I was just like, oh, I think like, oh, this guy knows a lot about food. I don't know why he knows a lot about food. I don't know why he, you know, appreciates food in the way that he does. But, you know, I think, you know, it just seemed to me that the way he was writing, it rang true to me, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was writing about restaurants that I had never been at and probably will never go to. But at the mm-hmm. same time, it just felt genuine for whatever reason.
Yes.
Which was refreshing because I find that, like you said, you know, most food writing that I had been exposed to, whether it's like, you know, in cities that I was living and working in, or, you know, just reading criticism of restaurants in, you know, like maybe New York or other food criticism in big cities in the States or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're right. Like it's the, in most cases, there is this rhythm where you're only writing about a restaurant if it's new or there's something noteworthy to say, because there are so many restaurants to write about and you want to, you know, find something interesting to bring to your readers. And, you know, the easiest way to find something interesting is to find something novel. And that's usually something that they haven't been exposed to yet. And the easiest way to do that is to go to newly opened restaurants and check them out and give an opinion on it. And so, yeah, when you open a restaurant, there is this, like from the restaurateur's perspective, there is this sort of like media kind of attention that you can tap into. But it is like a very perishable resource, you know, like it only exists really when you open your restaurant. You have to somehow find a way to have some media attention focused on you. Sometimes it's by accident, but usually it's by letting people know in the city who are food writers or who know food writers that you're opening a restaurant and trying to get some attention or whatever. And then, yeah, like you said, you get maybe a spot on some local media. You get a review in a newspaper. You get a few food bloggers that come around and write about your place. And then sometimes if you get some positive attention that way, that results in you getting some new customers. And then that's just gone forever. Like your restaurant is open. Nobody's coming back. You're now like, you know, now it's up to you to either find other ways to attract attention or just keep the customers that you have super happy and have them spread, you know, promotion about your restaurant by word of mouth or whatever it is. But it's sort of like you only have like one chance to have sort of like the light of like food writing focused on you, because your restaurant is no longer new after that.
Right.
And nobody gives a beep. And so, you know, like reading Jonathan Gold felt very refreshing because it felt like he wasn't just visiting new restaurants. He was just visiting restaurants that were new to him. And there were so many of them, you know. And I think, like, you know, if you look at the food writing in a city like Edmonton, you would feel like there aren't very many restaurants.
Right.
You know, because it's like a big surprise and everyone's talking about it when a new restaurant opens. But there actually really are a ton of restaurants here. Mm-hmm. And just for the most part, nobody talks or thinks about them, whether they be good or not.
Right.
You know,
that was one thing. I've never been to LA, actually. Have you?
I have never. Well, no, I've been in the airport.
Right.
I'm kind of dying to go. I've been kind of dying to go for a while, but
it's funny.
Now I'm really dying to go.
For me, like whenever I thought of California, with regards to food, my whole focus was just so fully set on San Francisco and Napa, right, because of Alice Waters and Thomas Keller and whatever else. LA was not on my, like, I knew taco stands. That's what I knew about LA food, basically. So yeah, it was not really on my radar at all. But what's cool about this collection is that, I mean, I would love to go to LA now. I don't think that necessarily you would get to eat at many of the restaurants that are, like, I don't know how many of these restaurants are still around. This collection is already more than 20 years old, right? But what was really great about it is that it had me thinking about Edmonton, because Edmonton's also a diverse place, not really the same as Los Angeles, but like in the Canadian context, Edmonton is a very diverse place. And so, like I mentioned in our last conversation, there were times where I would read a review of something in Counterintelligence and be like, oh man, I really need to hit up that spot on White or that spot on 97th in Chinatown, like, and try that dish. Like, because it's not the same people making it that he's writing about, but we have that. There's a community of people here that make that too. And so just in the last 3 weeks reading this book, like, I went for banh mi, I went for hand pulled noodles, I went to a Korean street food place by my house a few times, like, just inspired by learning more about, you know, the people who are cooking in Edmonton, who have similar backgrounds to what Gold writes about. But
yeah, totally. I think if there's a quantifiable difference between being in LA and being in Edmonton, like, I totally agree, there is a very diverse set of food cultures in Edmonton. I was shocked, like, when I first went to Europe.
Yeah, we've talked about this.
Found out, like, how narrow, like, in Copenhagen, which has changed a lot since I was there, thing one. You know, thing two, it, like, already is, like, or it sort of, like, feels like compared to most European cities, I would say, like, before I went, you know, my impression of, like, what European cities might be, like, the most diverse culturally, you know, were kind of, yeah, like, Scandinavian cities and Amsterdam. You know, like, those were sort of, I guess, in my mind, the more kind of, like, culturally diverse European cities. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, when I got to Copenhagen and realized, like, how, I mean, I was addicted to pho at the time. And right. I think there was, like, one restaurant.
Yeah. That's funny that you say that. Like, even within the Canadian, even, like, we've talked about how North Americans generally were fortunate to have, like, access to so many diverse cuisines. But even in the Canadian yeah. context, like, working in Naramata or in Penticton, around Penticton last year,
right.
there were specifically people, say, from Vancouver or from Edmonton who were like, you cannot eat pho here. There is no pho in Penticton. Maybe there is, but I don't know. And they were almost, like, in a weird way, homesick for homesick for something that wasn't ever really theirs, but they had access to
it. Right, exactly. Like, homesick for food yeah. that was not a part of their culture,
yeah,
but
yeah.
they were exposed to because their city is culturally diverse. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I guess, like, if there's, like, a fundamental difference between that diversity in Edmonton versus that diversity in LA, it's just that in LA, there's so much more. There's so many more people, and there's so much more actually happening that, like, I think that it, like, or this is obviously, I haven't been to LA, but you know, based on my impressions from counterintelligence, it's like the niches go much deeper.
Oh yes.
And therefore yeah. like, you know, and he makes some comments about it in a lot of the articles, like a lot of the restaurants that you go to, even in LA, you know, it's sort of like a pan-regional experience for whatever food you're having, right? Like, yeah. You know, if you're having most restaurants that have Pakistani food, it's like a very broad spectrum.
Yes.
But, you know, like in a lot of his articles, like, he mentions that, like, this restaurant does have that food, but they specialize in this because the owners are from here and the community that they're really serving is, like, this very regional kind of
yes.
set. And like, these are the things that if you want to know what they're like and have, like, a somewhat like, authentic cultural experience, this is the type of stuff that you should be thinking about ordering when you go to this place or whatever.
Yeah.
And there is some of that in Edmonton. Like, there are some wells of, like, hyper regionality within restaurants that offer, like, a pan regional sort of experience. But I think in LA there's just, like, so much more of it that you can find these, like, really authentic things. Like, when he talks about, like, there's one of the reviews that I read just before we got on the call was, like, about a banh mi shop. Mm-hmm. And he talks about a couple of banh mi shops and he's mentioning, like, all of these things that are, like, seem like, I mean, maybe it's easier to get the ingredients for them because LA is, like, kind of more tropical or something, or closer to tropical,
yep.
than we are in Edmonton. And so maybe it's just, you know, way harder or way more expensive to get the ingredients to make these things. But, like, he mentions things that sound, like, way more authentically Vietnamese than I feel like you would find in a banh mi shop in Edmonton. Mm. You know, and so I just feel like, you know, there's so many more people and it covers such a huge broadly cultural range in LA that there's just room for all these niches.
Right.
And
I think there's kind of,
because of that, like, if you want to make a spot for yourself within that cultural niche, you have to differentiate yourself a little bit.
Totally.
You know, in LA, because you know, you're competing with so much. And if you, you know, you really have to find like that, that community of people that really wants that thing that you're willing to offer, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's lots of great examples of that. Like even if you think about like, you know, Mexican food in Los Angeles, I don't think he breaks it down by region in the index the way that he does for China. Like if you look in the index, like right. all the restaurants are grouped by region or by cuisine style. And which one thing that's really cool is that the China section is broken down by province, which is really smart. Right. And you could see stuff like that in Edmonton. Like under China, there's like a whole category for Sichuan provinces and Yunnan, or sorry, for Sichuan restaurants and Yunnan restaurants and Cantonese restaurants. And I think you could see that in Edmonton very easily. Like there's one of the spots that I was inspired to go try is a Yunnan restaurant by my place that does those crossing bridge noodles that I mentioned to you a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Anyways, but yeah, you think about like how do you differentiate yourself as a Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles, where obviously yeah. there's a huge Mexican population. And so a lot of the reviews in Counterintelligence, kind of one of the, I mean, it's probably always been there, but one of the kind of trends at the time was that Oaxacan food was really like making a name for itself at that time. So he'll like talk mm-hmm. about how Oaxacan food is different than, you know, the stuff in Northern Mexico or Yucatan or whatever. And so, yeah, it's cool. I think there's kind of two sides of the coin where you mentioned like, yeah, because generally the immigrant communities in Los Angeles are going to be bigger than they are in Edmonton. And so there's more opportunity for them to serve their food like and make a real business of it. But also like the
and also have it be more diverse within
yeah,
that.
You yeah, know, totally. Like,
yeah.
But also the like the other side of it is like our own awareness of what the regionality is. And that the book has done a lot to open my eyes. So for instance, Latin exactly. food in Edmonton, like there is a Latin American immigrant community. It's obviously not even close to, it's not the same order of magnitude as you would see in Los Angeles, obviously. But, by my neighborhood, there's Paraiso Tropical, like a Latin market. And they sell, we've talked about this before, actually, like how there was also one where we worked in the Elm Catering Kitchen, and every so often we would go and get pupusas and curtido for lunch, from yeah. the kind of lunch counter in the shop. And to me, that was just, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say it, but that was just Mexican food to me. Like, yeah, it's a Mexican market. We would call it a Latin market or whatever, but
right.
I didn't realize until reading Counterintelligence that pupusas are a distinctly Salvadoran
thing, yeah.
Which, yeah. and if you, and then you start to look at some of the,
which I did know because, I worked with, Chilean gentleman, Jamie, one of my best friends at the time, when I was working on the Sunshine Coast and when I was working in BC, mm-hmm. And his now wife was Salvadoran and she made pupusas for us. And
yeah, cool.
In like, you know, the real way.
Right.
And it was amazing. That was my first exposure to pupusas. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
So
I was aware of that by luck.
So some of the like Latin American businesses in Edmonton that I'm aware of, like Paraiso and then also Acajutla on 107th Avenue, to mm-hmm. me, it was like, yeah, it's Latin. It's, I don't know, it's Mexican, whatever. But the people who opened Paraiso, they came to Edmonton in the 80s from Acajutla, which is a city in Salvador, in El Salvador.
Wow.
The same place.
I did not know that.
The owners of Acajutla obviously came from. And so you can kind of like, even though he's writing about LA, to those people were on the same journey. Like there was political upheaval in El Salvador in the 80s and a kind of diaspora that left the country. Mm-hmm. And some of them ended up in Edmonton. Some of them ended up in Los Angeles. So what I really appreciate about the book is it has me looking at Edmonton in a completely different and hopefully a more nuanced way. But
yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I like so far, and I'm not that far in, but some of it as I'm reading, I'm like cataloging all of the Edmonton restaurants that I know of that have similar cuisines.
Totally.
And I'm like,
yeah, totally.
You know, can I get this? There's a lot of stuff that I've never heard of,
yes.
you know, the dishes, the like hyper-regional dishes that he talks about in a lot of in a lot of his reviews, I'm like, never even heard of it. Like, no idea what it is. Looking it up, trying to figure out what it is, trying to figure out what region it's from. You know, and then thinking about restaurants that I am aware of in Edmonton that I think it's possible that they have that, and I just never noticed, or or whatever.
Totally, yeah.
It's inspiring to like have a little bit of fresh eyes for Edmonton, but it's also just like astonishing to me, like unbelievable how much, like how deep his food knowledge is. And I just, I'm not like, I find myself wondering all the, basically with every review that I read, I wind up wondering like, what is his previous exposure to this thing that he's talking about?
Yeah.
You know, like not in like, sometimes partially in like a critical thinking kind of way where I'm like, you know, it seems like he knows a lot about this, but does he, you know, like, or is he just representing it that he does? And like, you know, he's talking about something that I don't have a lot of knowledge about. And so obviously he knows more than I do about it, but like, where does his knowledge come from?
Yeah.
And then when you watch the documentary about him, it's like, the feel of the documentary to me, like I found myself wondering a lot, like, has he gone to these other places and like traveled around and seen like the regional diversity and all of the cuisines that he's talking about? And that's how he's so aware of these things. Or is he just like obsessively asking questions to the restaurant owner or something to try and contextualize the food that he's eating?
Right.
Or, you know, like, is he just like, here's a food that I've never heard of, there must be a book about it, I'm just going to go read this entire book about it? And when you watch the documentary, his house, which he lives in with his wife and child.
Yeah, three kids, yeah.
Is like, I wouldn't call it like a hoarder home necessarily, but like there are books covering stacked like 10, 12 high on like every horizontal surface in the entire house, aside from the table that he sits at in his kitchen to actually do his writing.
Yes.
The staircase, each stair is like along the side of the staircase is like stacked with like six or seven books tall, like I don't know if all of those books are about food. I doubt that they are. But like I was looking at, trying to look at the spines of a lot of them, and there are like tons of food books. I think he's read like every food book that was published in the States in like the last 30 or 40 years or something. I don't even know.
Yeah. I think there's a few parts to that, to the broad question, how does he know so much about food?
Right.
So you're right. The reading is a big thing. In the documentary, they talk about how he came up in a fairly academic household. Like his father wanted to be an English professor or had a degree in English or something. And that they, it was a, I guess, an erudite kind of cultured family. He reads voraciously. His, like, he and his wife are both career editors and writers, right? So it makes sense that they're, it's a very literary household. So that definitely is an important piece of it. There's also the one thing that I was hoping the documentary would address, because I was wondering it constantly while reading Counterintelligence, is how well traveled he is. If I had to speculate just based on, because I don't think that he I don't think he ever tries to present himself as an authority on something that he doesn't understand. There's lots of writing in Counterintelligence where he's talking about like having awkward fumbling conversations with the restaurant staff to try and understand what a dish is, or like asking them to translate and stuff like that. He doesn't present himself as a, like, you know, I know absolutely everything about everything. But if I had to speculate, it sounds like he's traveled through Central and South America. Cause he does make specific references to, like, you know, eating feijoada or whatever in Brazil. And like okay, worry, right. being worried that the next time he tastes an authentic whatever from Brazil will be when he's in Bahia next time or whatever it is. The way he writes and describes a lot of the, say, Chinese regional styles, it doesn't sound to me like he's traveled there, but he's been exposed to it. It does so
seem
much.
To me, though, like I caught a couple things that made it seem like he had traveled in Southeast Asia a fair amount.
Oh, is that right? Okay, I can't remember any.
It's like things that he said. I don't know, just not necessarily about eating things in places, but mm-hmm. just about the regionality of things. I don't know, but yeah.
But to me, what is most impressive, like besides like being an intelligent, well-read guy, the sheer number of meals he has eaten in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
is like even before he was a food critic. Like you're benefiting from this lifetime of enjoying food in the city, because he talks about, especially in the documentary, they put a fine point on it that each of these places that he writes about, he has been to multiple times. One of them, he thinks that one of them he went to 17 times before he wrote about it. And so the sheer, like the accumulation of experience and taste memories that he has from the different dishes, from the different restaurants, is staggering. Like it's,
yeah.
There's like, I don't know anyone who has that kind of that same experience eating out. So
no. And it just like, yeah, when they say that in the documentary, you know, or when he says that, like, you know, he thinks his record for trying a place is like 17 times before he wrote about it. Mm-hmm. I was just like, he's written about so many places, even if like some of them he only ate at like 3 or 4 times before he decided to write about it, which I think would feel very limited mm-hmm. to him. Mm. Like it must be, I find myself like wondering, like, how do you have time to write when every day you have to plan for every meal that you're going to eat to be somewhere in a place that's like useful for your writing?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Like he must have breakfast at home sometimes, but I don't. Like,
well, that's the thing, because he also talks about cooking at home a lot, like certain dishes that he can't get. He tries to make them at home and stuff. But yeah, anyways, it's not our area of expertise, but to talk about the quality of writing really briefly, like it is very, it's besides that kind of boring, rhythm of food criticism where you're only writing about the hot new thing and really focused on a kind of scene, besides doing the opposite of that, he also like has uncommonly compelling, the actual language is really fantastic. It's concise but like vivid and funny and interesting and unique in a way that like maybe some of the big food writers whose works are not like granular criticism of specific restaurants, like their works last for decades after they've written it. But this is interesting to me because it's like, it's writing from a periodical, from a LA Weekly about, nitty gritty here and now restaurants, but it's like fascinating, like a joy to read decades later. Yeah. And to give you some ideas, like in terms of a unique voice and humor, like he does these really wonderful, like hilarious hyperboles, say when he's like describing the size of something or how hot it is or how garlicky it is, like it'll be like for the size of something. Like I remember one that's like, it's like empanadas the size of handbags, or like pizzas the size of manhole covers, or tortillas the size of bed sheets, like that kind of like I said hyperbole, exaggeration, and really funny descriptions of, like, because he eats some like ridiculously spicy food, Chinese, Mexican, whatever, and he's like, it's I don't know, like incandescent with chili or like radioactive with chili, or
one that like really struck me yesterday was like, I can't remember what it was, but it was like something. Oh, I think he's talking about falafel. I think it was in the falafel thing. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that like one version was as dense as a dwarf star.
Yeah, like, or like it approaches the density of plutonium, the atomic density of plutonium, or like,
yeah, it's and just like ridiculous and hilarious.
Yes, totally. And he often, like, I honestly think that one of the, besides like regular articles and prepositions stuff, like one word that he uses almost in everything is how garlicky something is. Just right. The word garlicky, but it'll say like it's enough garlic to stun a moose, or like it's enough garlic to lift you out of your seat. Or one that I really liked was I had never heard of it before, but it sounds like it's basically schnitzel, but it's like in Latin America they make like these cutlets called milanesa. And he said it's so wide and so thin that you could fold it like a paper airplane and sail it across the dining room, which I just love. Like just that kind of imagery. Like it's not, there's no cliches in his writing, right? Like it's yeah. very inventive and, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's so funny because, you know, like it feels like his writing is like compelling on so many levels. Like, yeah, talking about that one sort of item or whatever is just like one of these like many levels that I, you know, while I'm reading it, like I'm appreciating what's happening mm-hmm. in the writing. Mm-hmm. You know, like the other thing for me that like really stands out is that like it feels like he's not satisfied to like, I'm not sure the best way to word this, but like it feels like he's not satisfied to just provide you with an idea of what the food is going to be like at a place. But like it feels like his intention is to try and make you feel like really give you a sense of place. Like yes. where you are when you go to this restaurant, what it feels like when you go in the door, whether that is good or bad, or like without even making a judgment about it. That's, I don't know. It feels like the most judgment-free criticism I've ever read.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Like, I don't know. Like there are judgments in it for sure. Like, you know, he says that, you know, he really says that there are things that he loves and dislikes about tons of the restaurants that he writes about. Mm-hmm. But it's like, to me, the big difference and what I feel about most modern food writing is that, like, I feel weird trying to articulate this because it feels a bit like a blanket statement. And I know that not everyone's food writing is like this, but it feels to me like the statement, or like feels to me like the sort of underlying current of like modern food writing is you're like providing a judgment or a criticism of the entire experience of going to a restaurant. And if you're writing about a restaurant, your review is either going to have like a positive or a negative bent. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why that is because I think that for most modern food writers or most modern food critics, the like question that they're trying to answer for their readers and for like the public, the dining public, you know, if their intention is to provide a service to the dining public, you know, the question that they're most often trying to answer is like, should you go here?
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
Yep.
And like the thing about gold is that it's sort of like the assumption on his part is that if you're reading his review, it's like you are a fellow adventurer.
Right.
Or something.
Yep.
And he is not trying to provide you with an idea of whether you should go or not. He just assumes that you're probably going to want to go to every restaurant
exactly.
the same way that he yes. does.
Yes, exactly.
But that like he's trying to provide like a more of a like a holistic guide for you to understand whether that's the type of experience that you want to try and go after,
right?
Because you have infinite options, right? Like you have infinite options about like different types of cuisine that you can try and different areas of the city that you can try it in and different times of day that you might want to go to different areas of the city to try and find different types of food. And he's just trying to give you like a very like his most kind of like unbiased picture of what you can expect when you go to a restaurant, mm-hmm. because he's just assuming that you want to go there as much as he did.
That's exactly right. It's like, if he writes, it's not even that he, it's not like, you know, because he's writing about it, it must be so good that you should go. It's like, in his mind, it's a restaurant. Restaurants are awesome. It's so fun to eat out. Of course you should go out to this restaurant. But if you find yourself here, here's what's special. Here's what they do well. Here's maybe what you should avoid. Yeah.
And I think like, you know, when I was watching the documentary, I see like a lot of other food writers. They're like, oh, you know, when I go to a Jonathan Gold restaurant, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know what to expect. You know, like, is it in a really rough neighborhood? Am I going to like feel like I might get accosted on my way through the door or something? I think one woman says. But like, he doesn't shy away from that stuff. If you read his review of the place, I would feel like you would know that that's what it was going to feel like walking into that place, but kind of free of judgment about that, mm-hmm. or something, you know, like if a restaurant is in a sketchy area, he's not shying away from that, you know, and he usually says something about it or says that, you know, like you walk in and the decor is really old and they haven't changed anything in 20 years and things are dusty,
right?
But they have this amazing thing or like, and he also doesn't shy away from saying that, you know, there are things on the menu that he didn't like or, you know, but it doesn't feel like he's trying to pin a restaurant to the wall and say, oh, you know, like you made, you know, like, you have this one good dish, but your tacos are horrible. Right. Like, you know, he's just like, I wouldn't eat the tacos here. You can get them better at this other place.
Yeah.
But if you're, you know, like if you're in the market for this thing that this restaurant does well, this is the only place you can get it.
Yeah.
And like, he's not afraid to say something negative in his review of a spot, but it doesn't feel like he's dwelling on it ever.
No.
You know, he's just
being
like
self-righteous about it.
No, you know, he's just giving his experience so that he can give you your best shot at knowing what to expect when you go there. Mm. You know,
I actually like some of the most memorable descriptions are of the customers. Like he'll not in every single review, but he'll describe the people who eat there regularly. And it's just such a vivid glimpse into you can picture sitting in the dining room. I don't know.
I was reading one about a Punjabi restaurant yesterday that was exactly like that. He's talking about all these businessmen that come in and are just like talking on their cell phones and that's just like the vibe, you know, and they go there because that's where they get their lunch, because that's where it's the only place where you can get the food that they want.
Right. I don't know if you think this is tedious, I can stop or we can cut it out, but like I can read, like I have like earmarked some of the pages that just have descriptions of the customers. Is that too tedious?
No, let's do it.
And it gives you some of these descriptions of the places and the customers. You start to appreciate that, yes, he loves food, but he really gets Los Angeles, understands Los Angeles, and loves it. This maybe it will eventually be a good springboard to us talking about his association with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, but
maybe.
Anyways, sorry.
Just before you get into that, and like this is somewhat topical to this particular part of his writing, but to me, and I don't know, maybe someone who's read a lot more than I have might think that this is a ridiculous thing to say, but to me, the experience of reading his reviews was like reading a Charles Bukowski novel.
Okay. How so?
And have you ever read any Charles Bukowski?
No, not a word.
Do you know who he is?
Yes.
So he's an LA writer and poet, novelist, I guess from like the 70s and 80s primarily. And he wrote a couple of books that got turned into movies, and he was like kind of a very famous novelist in his time, but like from a very kind of, I don't know the best way to describe it. He had a pretty rough life.
Yeah.
He was also an immigrant, I believe, or was born was the son of immigrants. Yeah.
Like he was very famously alcoholic and often very hard up
homeless.
And homeless. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And his books, his writing is like pretty crude. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is like challenging to read, misogynistic and stuff. It's like, I definitely wouldn't call it like fun, but it's extremely compelling in that it has this similar sort of like lack of judgment about the circumstance. Like, I don't know. A lot of his writing is actually like, I hate this person and I hate that person and I hate this place. And but at the same time, it's also just like a very like, it's definitely not ego free either, but it's just sort of like this. I don't know the best way to explain it, but it just feels like there's no hesitation about chronicling things, whether they're good or bad.
Right.
And basically like value judgments about things that are good or bad sort of become like unimportant, because the writing is really about like getting the sense of what it's like to be in a certain situation or what it's like to be in a certain place. And I just remember that feeling of like that, what I just remember that being the compelling part of the writing to me. It's sort of like also written in vignettes, kind of those same, counterintelligence feels like a bunch of vignettes to me, even though there's no narrative. And in a Bukowski novel, usually there is sort of a narrative, but it's mostly just like each chapter is sort of like a vignette about something that happens.
Right.
And it's sort of like this, in a way, like a judgment-free kind of chronicling of just this occurrence. And then it's up to the reader to sort of like have a value judgment about it if they want, you know? And when I have been reading like Jonathan Gold's accounts of like, the customers or the way a place looks or the neighborhood that it's in, it feels like, you know, he's just saying like, this is the reality of this place, and this is why it has its charms, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just like, I don't know, it feels like a much more niche to me and holistic version of that,
right?
Or something. Yeah, or like niche to me and much more wholesome, sorry. Like much more wholesome version of that.
Yes. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Anyway. Sorry for that digression, let's hear some passages about the people that dine in these restaurants.
Some of these are very straightforward, but to me still paint the picture for you.
Are you going to say the name of the restaurant?
I can, yeah. For instance, Shabalita's Tacos. The customers range from truckers to cops, hood rats to priests, and a huge contingent of little kids, many of whom end up taking turns wearing the security guard's hat. I just love that hood rats and priests and little kids stealing the security guard's hat.
And there's a security guard there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great
thing. And the kids steal his
hat. That's an element of, look, when you're picturing this place, it's the kind of place that has a security guard in it. Here's some of the clientele from Curry House. This is a Japanese curry house. At noontime, the curry house seems to serve as a commissary for the Japanese employees of the Hotel Nikko across the street. Later on, the restaurant fills up with hip professionals, bearded entertainment guys, and the Japanese hotel guests themselves, who can be spotted by Tokyo haircuts and Chanel purses so new that they squeak. And then this is probably...
When you're in Tokyo, you realize that every Chanel purse that you see only goes out for one day.
Oh, I see, yeah. And this is... probably Gold at his cheekiest. But here's a description of the customers at a restaurant called Julien. On a sunny day, the tables at Julien are jammed with the genetically gifted, whose perfect cheekbones, even teeth, and straight blonde hair seemed to have been polished through several generations of careful breeding, a vivid cross-section of people who wouldn't have talked to you in high school. So he's not, like, that's a little bit, I mean, he's that, like I said, that's him being extremely cheeky. He's not usually like that.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's still a fun description.
And I think when you like talk about that subtitle, that's like the real LA or something.
Yeah.
I think a part of that for him, and he says as much in the documentary, is that like he feels like living in LA, you never have so many. There's nowhere else where you live where you have so many people tell you what your city is like.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Tourists. Yeah.
And that like most people's perception of it, because, you know, a lot of people there are there either for a short period of time or as tourists, is like, yeah, just like venturing out in a 10 or 20 block radius, like from the place where they're staying and like, you know, maybe realizing how vast and how diverse the city is, but not having a chance to be exposed to it, mm-hmm. because there's just too much, you know? And I think, yeah, is like part of his motivation is trying to dig into that, mm-hmm. and like dig up all of that diversity, leave no corner of that diversity, however niche, like untouched by like his exploration, and therefore bring that to his readership or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And maybe like when you talk about how non-judgmental his writing voice is, like, I think one of the greatest examples of that is probably his profile of Dr. Dre in Rolling Stone. This is something, yeah. I can't even remember if we met. Like, so Jonathan Gold was a music critic before he was a food critic. He was a music critic. He grew up really interested in classical music, played the cello. But then the late 70s and 80s, like became interested in punk and hip hop, and wrote music criticism for LA Weekly. And then in 1993, so the year after The Chronic came out, he did an extended kind of profile of Dre and Snoop, in Rolling Stone magazine, which again, like it on the surface, it seems like such an incongruous kind of, just like the way that Jonathan Gold looked, like just, he's like, he's a big man, big white guy, kind of bald on the top, long flowing hair, usually wore like
sometimes
this kind
looking
of,
a little bit punk, sometimes looking a little bit bikerish, and sometimes just looking like a suburban white dude.
Yeah. Like, but often in, I don't know what, if this is like a certain period of time in his life, but like wearing these kind of billowing, like white shirts and suspenders, mm-hmm. and just like doesn't look cool. No offense, John, but doesn't look cool. But then like this profile of Dre, like he's not like saying this is the greatest music ever, but like he gets the music and like he likes the beats and he appreciates, like there's always something for him to appreciate and comment on and to provide criticism on. And if I tried to read as much about this as I could, but like apparently he was in the studio, like when Snoop was recording Doggy Style, half the time Jonathan Gold was in the studio with him. So he just seems like he's able to bridge all of these gaps and reach people.
Yeah, the article's pretty amazing because of the, like, because if you think about, you know, like, I don't know, if you've watched a lot of stuff about Snoop and Dre, and if you've watched a lot of media about hip hop from that time, it's, you know, it's very sensationalistic, mm-hmm. and it really lingers on these things that happened to Dre when he was like in his early career, you know, where he was getting arrested a lot and there was, you know, a lot of, you know, tough guy stuff going on, and, you know, but that's all like anyone dwells on, and Gold actually like digs into that stuff, mm-hmm. but not in a way that's like trying to, you know, paint a thuggish portrait of Dre. It's like, this is a person and these things are happening in his life, and what is that like, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's fascinating. Like he he talks about this interaction that he sees in the studio where this rapper Corrupt, he has a bunch of pieces on Doggy Style, he has a bunch of verses on Doggy Style. Mm-hmm. Goes to Snoop in the studio and says, "Oh my God, I've got it! Like this is, yeah. I nailed it." And he performs these like verses for Snoop, and then Snoop just kind of like shrugs it off, and then Corrupt like goes away and is like obviously devastated. Yes. And just the way that Jonathan Gold like describes that interaction, mm-hmm. is like so humane, like it's so human.
Yes,
like it's such a relatably human experience, like everyone in the room thinks they're the best rapper ever, and yes. everyone's making millions of dollars that they thought that they would never see, and there's like all this like crazy stuff going on and all these egos flying around, but these people still have to interact and like and give each other approval and not do that and feel hurt and feel frustrated and right. It's just he finds like the most kind of human corner of the thing that he's trying to write about and just, mm-hmm. tries to reveal that,
I think my favorite part of the Rolling Stone piece is Dr. Dre being frustrated with the media for focusing right. on the violence and misogyny and homophobia in his lyrics, where he's like, "Well, yeah, I said that, but then why do you guys keep writing about it?" Like, and it sounds like a dumb, like contradictory thing to say. But because he's not even necessarily saying there's so much more in my music, but he's like, why are you on about it? Like, it's there. And it was an interesting contradiction that, again, Gold was just happy to portray it.
Right, not try to pull it out and be like, "Oh, here's the hypocrisy in
exactly.
gangster rap or exactly, something."
Exactly, yeah. And actually, and probably the extent to which he tries to call out Dre is just that Dre says, "Who even invented that term gangster rap anyways?" And then John Gold says to him in the interview, "You did." And then Dre says, "Oh, right, never mind." Yeah, it's a really good piece.
Yeah. It's I don't know. It's just telling, like, obviously he cares very much about both things, but then he also doesn't see them as like when I say both things, I mean obviously he really cares about food and obviously he really cares about music. Those are two things that are like very important to him. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, I don't know, this is just off the top of my head. Maybe this is stupid. but I feel like for a lot of critics, the thing that they're covering, becomes this like very important thing, right? Like mm-hmm. there's a lot, like maybe sometimes on purpose and maybe not, but like, a lot of food critics, it's sort of like when they talk about food, their writing makes it feel like it's kind of the most important thing in the world or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when I read Jonathan Gold's writing, I feel like I get the sense that everything that he covers is as important as it actually is in the broader context of the culture in the world.
Right.
Right. Like he's not necessarily trying to turn the specialty pupusas at any specific Salvadoran restaurant into like a cultural icon. Mm-hmm. He's just saying that like, there is this thing out there,
right,
and it is amazing for what it is, and you can go seek it out. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. And also, I think,
like, food isn't more important than food actually is. He's not trying to say that, like, everyone, like, everyone should be as obsessed with food as I am,
right,
or something, mm-hmm. Like, he, it feels like he has a very grounded idea of exactly how important the thing is that he's writing about. And that is, like, it is important to the people that feel like it's important. But it's also just like one component of this, vast culture, mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
What I appreciated most in the documentary in City of Gold, was it talking about the 92 LA riots? Because that's something that is kind of like,
right,
because the column went on much later than this, but I think that this collection, this counterintelligence collection, was published in the year 2000. So it's all from the 90s. And there's like fleeting references to the 92 riots. Like it'll say just something like, you know, this shop used to be here, but it burned in the 92 riots and now it's over there.
And they opened it somewhere else. Yeah, yeah.
But he never really like, it's not something that's just openly addressed really in any of these reviews, which makes sense. It would be out of place because it's supposed to be about the restaurants. But I really liked that the riots got a section in the documentary, because for someone who's like, first of all, so like a true Angeleno, which I didn't even know that was what you call someone from Los Angeles, but like right, Gold, okay, being a lover of Los Angeles, but also to be that kind of like the voice that is, you know, or like whatever, interested in his neighbors and what they're cooking and not judgmental, like the riots must have been like, that must have been a very difficult time. Well, obviously for everyone, but for him, like, and for how he saw the city, yeah, and how he did his work. So yeah, I think that the documentary actually ends with that discussion and a short essay that he wrote shortly after the riots.
But. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The documentary ends with him giving a reading, I think.
Hey. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I kind of skimmed it. So I didn't get all the context. I kind of do remember that it covers that, but I don't remember exactly, I guess, what his feeling about it was. But why don't I take a guess, and then you can tell me if I'm correct. Mm. Because yeah, and I guess I have some context clues from what you just said. But yeah, it feels to me like, you know, that would feel very affronting to what his view of the city is like this, you know, He calls it a mosaic. He calls it a brilliant mosaic, yeah, at one point, right, in the documentary. I think that must have been very disillusioning for him to see like the communities that he feels are so integral to making the city what it is and what makes it fascinating to him. You know, like in a way, coming into conflict with each other, mm-hmm, not necessarily purposefully, but like definitely, you know, in those riots, there was a lot of like racial tension, not just between like the Black community and the rest of the city, or the Black community and the police or the establishment or whatever, but you know, like intercultural, mm-hmm, sort of kind of conflict in terms of like neighborhoods and people feeling like they were being invaded by people from other neighborhoods and, mm-hmm, things like, totally, that,
yeah,
and
yeah,
everybody having to board up their shops to try and protect them from their neighbors. And it just must have felt very disillusioning to him, because, you know, he I think that he saw that as the city's strength, and it really turned into something horrific in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Like that's the piece that he reads, and actually I think he's introduced by his wife Lori, and she mentions, okay, that like after the riots, there was like this, for a lot of people, a feeling in the city of like trying to reach out to people and, you know, start the healing and all that,
right,
and learn who your neighbor is. And the pieces, I think that if you read it without knowing that it was that it was written shortly after the 92 riots, like you might not make you probably wouldn't make the connection. It's not mentioned explicitly, but it's basically, right, he describes his neighborhood, and it kind of meanders a bit, but he ends up talking about, he knows that his landlords, like in the place that he lives, are Korean, and he sees them.
Yeah.
Sometimes he'll go to hang out his laundry, but there's like cabbage leaves hanging on all, like all the lines are taken up by cabbage leaves or smoked fish or something like that. And the last line is something just like, I wish that they would invite me to dinner or something like that. So
yeah,
it's like, it's poignant in the context of the riots, especially I guess with the landlords being Korean. Cause I think like a lot of the fires and violence happened in Koreatown, and there, like you said, there was this,
right,
at least the way it was portrayed in by the media, like this tension, yes, but obviously between African Americans and police enforcement, but also like between Korean Americans and African Americans.
Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, it's a really short, simple piece, but yeah, it was a really excellent end to the documentary. So.
Yeah. Like his last line in it is so poignant. Like it's sort of like, because yeah, his last line is like, I wish they would, you know, invite me in for dinner. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of heartbreaking because it's like, he's put so much time and effort into exploring all of these like little cultural pockets, but he still feels like he hasn't really been able to like penetrate culturally into like the niches that he really wants to be in. Mm-hmm. And that's like, what do these people eat at home? Right. You know, like, yeah, what is everyone in Los Angeles eating at home? Yes. You know, like I can find out kind of what they're eating by like going to a food truck or going to a restaurant or whatever, but like I really want to know like what is everybody like, you yeah. know, what's their life, you know. Mm-hmm. And that comes through in the writing, but it's, you know, like it's apparent when he says that he still doesn't feel like he's done a good enough job of like chronicling what the real
right
cultural of what the real culture of LA is. Mm. It's pretty crazy.
The last time that we were talking about 1992, you finished the episode with a little clip of Crisscross. And so I'm assuming that now you'll be able to play a little bit of the Chronic.
Listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.